as a black woman, as a young black woman doing comedy, I really don't want to do what people think I'm going to be doing. I just always want to be able to move. And I think it's so easy to be trapped in a box of like, oh, this is the sort of comedy you do. It's black comedy, or it's female comedy, or it's clean comedy, or dirty comedy. And, you know, you don't know what I'm going to do. So there.
I'm Lily Percy, and this is Creating Our Own Lives, Cool for short, the podcast where I ask people to think through how they shape their lives. And hopefully by listening, we learn how to create our own. This season on Cool, we're talking about humor as a tool for survival. Except that when I think of Alexis Wilkinson, I want to rewrite that as humor as a tool for success. She's a writer on Brooklyn Nine-Nine and previously wrote for Veep, a job that she got right out of college at the age of 22. Before that, she made headlines as the first African-American woman to be president of Harvard's Lampoon magazine. All of that success is impressive, but what can be easily forgotten is how hard Alexis worked to achieve it. She campaigned to be president of the Lampoon, and in her senior year, she sent writing samples, resumes, email after email to get her breakthrough TV writing job. This is the same girl who wanted to be a biomedical engineer, and despite having a terrific GPA, applied to 18 colleges to make sure that happened. Alexis cares deeply about what she does, and her work shows it. So, you know, the theme of this series is humor as a tool for survival, which I know that you have kind of written about in many ways through your writing and just your life. And I wonder if we could just start by talking about who was the person that made you laugh the most when you were growing up?
The person who made me laugh the most. This is so awful. You know, my original thought was like, yeah, me.
That's totally allowed. Own it. Own it, girl. Do it.
No, I mean, I think I was, my sister is hilarious, and I make her read everything I write ever, and I'm going to probably have to start paying her at a certain point because she's going to med school, and it's like, so I need to study, so I can't really read all your scripts and everything.
Is she older or younger?
Younger, but only by 18 months, so we're very close. So she's very, very funny, and I think she has sort of slightly different tastes. Like, she sort of always understands what joke I'm trying to make, and but also is a little, doesn't like it, like sort of more blue stuff that I might do. But I mean, I think I entertained myself a lot when I was younger, just, you know, writing. I mean,
did you make your mother laugh doing that kind of stuff?
No. She doesn't think I'm funny at all.
Really?
It sounds kind of mean. But being a comedy writer or sort of viewing comedy as a skill is not really a thing in my family. Not that you wouldn't think your relatives are funny or something like that, but it wouldn't. I was never noticeably funnier than anybody, you know? It was never like my mom's like, oh, that's my funny kid. It's like, no, I'm just weird and make too much noise a lot of the time. And, you know, sometimes and occasionally, you know, inappropriate. But
that's so interesting because I know your dad was a chemist, right? And your mom was a computer engineer. So you've said you were a big math and science nerd growing up. So I'm wondering is there a moment, because there may not be, but was there a moment when you realized, I'm funny? Like, you made someone laugh and you're like, no, I'm really funny.
I mean, I always kind of, you know, I have a really big need for constant validation. So, you know, I definitely really the positive reinforcement of making people laugh. I always really sort of sought that out. And, you know, it's like, yes, put it into my veins. I need it. But I think I never really, again, appreciated it as kind of a skill, like an important skill on its own until maybe my senior year of high school when I'd already gotten into college and I started a sort of satirical little newsletter with one of my best friends who we had been co-captains of the debate team together. My friend Joe. Hi, shout out to Joe, who was at Princeton. He's a genius. Love him to death. And so we started this little like satirical like, Onion-style newsletter, like just one page front and back, black and white, and sort of articles about, you know, the hamster being concerned that, like, the snake moving into the science room was ruining the neighborhood and, like, you know, stuff like that. And we just did it because it was fun and we just thought it was amusing. But I think having positive reactions to that and having, you know, teachers and other students, like, really look forward to it and be like, when is amateur night? We called it amateur night. We are the knights. Pun. And hilarious, right? So highbrow stuff. Stuff was real highbrow.
You guys have been so popular. So popular.
Right? The coolest kids. But, I mean, also, that's the other thing. I think I you know, I feel like you sort of do an autopsy on your high school experience. Like, was I popular? Like, was I cool?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. And especially, I think my school didn't have really super set cliques that were, you know, it wasn't clear, like, here's the hierarchy. And I sort of mostly just floated around. Like, I wasn't, I was well known and not disliked. I did a lot of stuff. I was in debate and mock trial and, you know, I tutored and, God, what else did I do? Volleyball and I did a bunch of different.
So many activities. And I was like, when did you have time to just chill?
Didn't.
That's how you got into Harvard. No kidding.
Exactly. Chill was not on the agenda. I mean, again, even telling jokes and stuff, I'm like, I have to have a newsletter. We're going to make this an extracurricular. Like, what's wrong with me?
So one of the things that I read that you wrote in Lenny Letter, it was called Owning It. And I love what you're writing about owning spaces.
Yeah.
And you said, you know, I have strong feelings about space and things. At the worst times in my life, I haven't had a lot of either. And I think that's true for most people. People need space. People need to feel like they have some semblance of control over their environment. People need a place to belong. And that resonates so much, you know, with me and I'm sure with so many people, but especially people of color. And you've talked about kind of what it was like growing up in Milwaukee and going to Harvard. And I wonder how humor helped you kind of take control of those spaces.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't say that I was or am a real I don't perform primarily. Like, I do occasionally, but I'm a writer. And so I think I always feel like when you say you write comedy or something, it's a classic thing. Like, you can sing me a song right now, you know. And so it's like, oh, you write comedy? Tell me a joke. You know,
you're exactly.
Like, God, like, oh, I'm going to kill myself. Stop. And so I think I don't think I'm the sort of person who naturally takes control of those spaces by, like, telling jokes and sort of being a big character. But I think a lot of times, like, using on an individual level, especially just dealing with people, like, using humor to, like, disarm them and also just in my own head to sort of take apart those things that were happening and make them funny to myself and so that I didn't focus on them anymore. And then turning them into, like, oh, this horrible thing that happened, that's actually a funny story because, you know?
Yeah.
And sort of being able to sort of weaponize it and sort of... It's funny, and this is, like, only the, especially using the word weapon, the only most obvious, especially coming from a place like Veep, like, insults, a very clever insult can do a lot. If you get the person you're insulting to laugh, that's really a great feeling. And I remember once, I had just been elected president not too long ago, and I was doing this internship, and I had my email out in public, which I will never do again. Nobody
terrible
needs to
mistake.
Talk to me ever. And so, you know, especially not random, you know, racists from the internet.
Ugh.
And so I got this really long email and the subject line was like, Alexis Wilkinson, you make me want to vomit. And it was the first time I had gotten something so like, I was like, oh, hello. how can I help you, sir?
Exactly.
Like,
what are you even supposed to say to that?
Right. Okay. Like, I don't. Why did you? And so I went this long thing and it was like clearly like racial and just weird. And that like I was, you know, some privileged Obama like. It was not about me. It had nothing to do with
at
me.
All.
And I remember, and like this is probably the only time or one of the few times I've ever responded to stuff like that. I'm very good at mute, block, delete. I don't care. You're not relevant to my life, whatever. But I just thought it was so funny and so specific, this vomit. He kept just saying he was going to vomit over and over again. And I wrote back on a not very long response, but said something like, hello, sir. Like, thank you so much for your kind message. It is so great to know that people like you are out there and, like, you are the reason I continue to do what I do. And, like, thank you so much for assuming so much about me. Like, I'm sure, like, my single widowed mother and, you know, my family and stuff, I'm sure they would really appreciate that you appreciate the struggles that we all have gone through. And if you're still feeling nauseous, may I recommend Pepto-Bismol? Here's a link. I have a coupon. That's for you. Cheers, Alexis. And he wrote back and actually said something like, okay, that was kind of funny. Like, I think that's what he
did. He
said.
Really?
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah, right? Look
you
at that.
You made a
Look
racist laugh. Look at
right?
that.
Right? He was like, okay, that was kind of funny. And I was like, that's right, you son of a bitch.
It's the most you're going to
get out of my inbox. Be gone. So, you know, I think that's a good example.
One of the things I really kept thinking about in kind of reading about you was, you've been the first in so many ways, like the first, you know, black woman to be the president of Harvard's Lampoon, you know, one of the youngest, if not the first young 22-year-old comedy writer to be hired. That's a lot of pressure. And I just kept wondering, like, how did you deal with that?
I didn't. I think I put a lot of pressure on myself. And I think, you know, we were talking about how much stuff I did in high school. And I think I have learned now to be a little easier on myself just generally, and also just not to trying to think of the right way to say this. I think sometimes you need to just like telescope out, like really far out in a certain situation to just say it's okay. Like if I focus on any one given thing or focus on what one person might be thinking or letting one person or one group of people down, then I can freak out and I can feel a lot of pressure and, you know, feel like a pressure cooker because I'm in this small space. And so I try to, whenever I'm doing that to myself, just sort of be like, okay, let's really take stock of everything. Where are you right now? What are you doing? How are you feeling? And sometimes it's, especially when I first moved out here and when I started working at Veep and I was so scared and so nervous and I was just like, oh my God, this is a huge mistake. And, you know, imposter syndrome style, like, oh my God, the jig is up. Yeah. It's up. You know, I'm going to humiliate myself and it's going to be the worst thing that's ever happened. And I think, you know, I realized like I am 22 years old. I have a great job. I live in California. It's great. I have a great boyfriend. I have great friends. Everything is fine. It's all fine, you know? And I'm not poor anymore. Yeah. Like, you know,
exactly.
It's fine. Everything is fine. And so I think sometimes just really trying to big picture it and just that really helps me stop from just cannibalizing myself about the little things.
Mm. I have to ask, how is writing for Veep? I mean, you wrote there, and I saw on Twitter as well that another writer, Rachel Axler, is that how you say her name?
Yeah.
She credited you with one of my favorite lines when Jonah was running for Congress, believe in yourself so hard. Believe in yourself so hard. But
yeah,
I wonder
yeah.
how the transition from writing from Veep to Brooklyn Nine-Nine has been, because they're very different tones.
Oh, yeah. And you can't swear, really.
No.
You can't even say scumbag. What the fuck? Like, I don't... I went from a show where you could have a whole episode centered around the word cunt.
Yeah, literally.
You can't even say scumbag without it's like, oh, and you can't say Santa isn't... Like, what is going on? What is this? So that's been a hard adjustment. Just taking all the fun, colorful swears out of my life.
Yeah. It's a fine line.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm so curious. There's a. I remember reading in an interview that you did in Playboy, very, very.
Oh boy.
Yeah. No.
Fun times. My mom loved that. Loved it.
You weren't posing in Playboy. You know, we all read it for the articles.
I know it doesn't make a difference.
You talked about how the first time you wrote a dark joke for Veep anonymously, that when people found out it was yours, they were like, the writers were shocked. What was the joke? I'm so curious.
Oh man, I'm going to mess it up. Furlong was Roger Furlong, character, was talking to, I think, Dan and Amy when they were doing the recount stuff. And maybe Dan and Amy and Jonah. I can't remember the exact context now. God,
no
it's
worries.
Been so long. But basically, he said something to the effect of, you know, I've been doing this since before your mother was throwing herself down a flight of stairs belly first. And so that was my joke. And that got, when it was read, a big like, ooh.
Why do you think the other writers were shocked that that came from you?
I mean, they didn't know me that well at the time. I think on that show, particularly like the British writers that were working there at the time, like they sort of had the reputation of doing like this really dark stuff. So I think they just sort of assumed that it must have come from one of them. And also I was kind of still warming up. And so I didn't really make big swings that often with my jokes where it's like, okay, this is going to go awesome, or they're going to be like, I don't get it, or like, ew, like, that's gross and terrible, like, don't say stuff like that. But, I mean, that never happens. But, you know, you learn that. So, you know, it's really validating, again, to the veins, that when you can surprise people, and I think that's the other thing that, particularly as a black woman, as a young black woman doing comedy, I really don't want to do what people think I'm going to be doing. And that's just always been kind of a personal thing for me. I just always want to be able to move, and I think it's so easy to be trapped in a box of like, oh, this is the sort of comedy you do. It's black comedy or it's female comedy or it's clean comedy or dirty comedy. And, you know, you don't know what I'm going to do. So there, you know, you have no idea what I might say or what I might do or what I might be working on and what topics interest me. So I always am just striving to keep my portfolio diverse in that way. So that way I can always have a job, you know, because I can do a lot of different stuff.
That's that hard worker in you.
In
that same Playboy interview, I love that you said that you wanted your epitaph to be Alexis Wilkinson. Here she lies, a funny ass bitch till the end. That's perfect.
That's such a weird quote. Gosh, what's
this
wrong?
This is why your
me?
Mother why was horrified.
I, right? Why do I say the things that I say sometimes?
No filter.
Yeah, I guess. Right? I don't know.
So a last question for you. I wonder, you know, what does humor, what does laughter and joy really, because I think they're all tied together, what does it give you that you find nowhere else that you're grateful for?
I think it gives me release. And you see it in real life where something really, really bad happens, like truly bad. You know, you're at a funeral or something and then you go into the bathroom, like wash your hands and you just spill water all over your – and you like make eye contact with your aunt or something and you both just start cracking up uncontrollably and just die. And it's not that that was so funny. It's just sometimes there's just too much tension or everything and you just have to let it go. And I think – laughter is such a great natural physical response to do that, and I think that's what it's for. And so sometimes I think, I mean, I can't tell you how many times where I've been really, really crying, and then you do that whole, like, I mean, I try not to cry more than maybe like a couple times a year, because when I do, typically it everything comes out at once, and I end up doing that little kid, like, like double clutch, I can't even breathe,
yeah,
like,
it's the Oprah,
you know, falling
ugly cry.
Down, right, right? Like, so ugly, like, sniffling, snot is everywhere. I'm, like, crawling on the ground, like, uncontrollably racking my body. And then, like, the amount of times that evolves into just being like, God, you know, like laughing, like it never fails to surprise me. But yeah, I think it relieves a lot of tension. And I think for me, especially just the experiences I've gone to and just dealing with a lot of death in my life, like my father and, you know, aunts and uncles and grandparents and my roommate. And I think sometimes you just have to really let all that stuff go. And for me, being able to tell jokes and being able to laugh is so much a part of that.
Alexis Wilkinson is a staff writer on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, where she brings us hilarious moments every single week. And if you're on Twitter, follow her at Oh God It's Alexis and witness one of my favorite things. Alexis rewriting the lyrics to famous songs, such as Hold Me Closer, Uber Driver, Count the Headlights on the Highway, to the tune of Elton John's Tiny Dancer. Creating Our Own Lives is produced by Maya Terrell, Chris Hegel, and Trent Gillis, and is an On Being Studios production. You can listen and subscribe on iTunes or wherever you download podcasts, and leave us a review on iTunes. It matters more than you think. I'm Lily Percy. Thanks for listening.